So by way of introduction, my name is Todd Brewer. I run the website for Mockingbird. So it's my job. It's fun. It's thrilling. Every new week is an adventure. I also I've been to seminary. I have a PhD in New Testament. That's kind of my background. So I'm not going to reference any Greek. No, I will reference Greek. But I won't be boring about it. How about that? So first, the disclaimer. The disclaimer is that I will not talk politics in this talk about politics. There will be no stump speeches, no endorsements. I'm not going to reference any protests happening anywhere at the moment. I will practice what I preach. In doing so, Someone recently asked me how many friends I thought I might lose by the time November rolls around. It seems like an odd way to frame a semi-annual civic ritual, and also sort of disturbing lack of understanding about who I am. I have I do not post. But nevertheless, it reflects the breathtaking reach of political discourse, and what it has hold of us over everyday life. From what church you attend to what products you buy and everything in between, the culture war knows no bounds. As we begin the ascent of the 2024 campaign roller coaster, and as each day, each breaking news story lifts our proverbial cart higher and higher, I can imagine that the feeling of impending dread grows too. I don't necessarily mean a dread over the outcome of the elections, though perhaps that is the case for some or many, but a dread over all that will unfold between now and then, of all the ways the stresses of everyday life will feel amplified under the microscope of the quote-unquote most important election of our time, lifetime. Somehow, yet again. And so the kind of thematic picture that I think is fun is a poster from a protest of some sort. It says, November is coming. If we need more chairs, by all means, grab them. And there's ample room here. Absolutely. November is coming feels ominous, right? It harkens back to Game of Thrones. Winter is coming. Now, for some, this proverbial roller coaster is more thrill than fear, following the ups and downs of their side like one would watch a football game. And certainly the gamification of politics encourages such a view. For others, politics is a source of anxiety over all the potential consequences it might have. Such anxieties may be either real or imaginary, depending on the issue. But regardless of one's attitude, all of these take their bearings from the political. To many of us, it might seem obvious that the political landscape would evoke such an affective response. After all, how can one feel happy when that guy is at the helm? But emotion is the currency of political propaganda, principally because turnout is a major predictor of electoral success. The more investment one has in the cause, the more ensnared one is by political theater, the more likely worshipful adherents will not just vote, but also tithe and proselytize to unbelievers. But perhaps there is another way, a way to stay sane amid the tumult. In this talk, we'll aim for just that. We'll see if I'm successful. As we navigate through the writings of a 1940s German philosopher by the name of Wilhelm Kammler, as well as his doctoral supervisor, Martin Heidegger, we'll look at punk music, Jesus, and the Apostle Paul. So we first begin with Wilhelm Kammler. Kammler was a philosopher who is so obscure that this is the best photo I could find of him. Here at this the beginning of this breakout session, Kamla is a philosopher whose views are as much a cautionary tale as they are instructive. He is a philosopher of little note within Germany and entirely unknown outside of it. He began his academic career in 1931 after writing a book on the Book of Revelation before becoming a philosopher and forsaking religious inquiry altogether, for the most part. His next book, published in 1940, was entitled Christianity and Self-Assertion, Historical and Philosophical Investigations into the Origins of Christianity and Augustine's Citizenship of God. That is a mouthful. That is the most German title ever. They are very descriptive. Now, this title, Christianity and Self-Assertion, may not sound particularly interesting to us, but in the context of 1940s Nazi Germany, it was provocative, if not incendiary. You see, Kamla was a student of the philosopher Martin Heidegger. Heidegger is a philosopher of much more note. I found a great photo of him, dating... This photo comes from 1933, the precise period in which I'm about to talk. Because in 1933, Heidegger caused a great tumult in Germany when he stepped in as the president of the University of Freiburg that spring. The previous president, Wilhelm von Mollendorf, was a member of the Liberal Democratic Party and was quickly ousted by the Nazis upon their rise to power in January of that year. In exchange for this esteemed appointment, Heidegger officially joined the Nazi Party. It was a quid pro quo. Heidegger then gave his inaugural presidential address in May of that year, giving a paper entitled The Self-Assertion of the German University. In this call to action, Heidegger reflected and endorsed Nazi propaganda of the time, defending their practice of censorship, and repeatedly emphasizing how the university most properly functions in service of the state, and, quote, the spiritual mission of the German people. Now, back to Kamla. In his book, Christianity and Self-Assertion, recalls Heidegger's earlier arguments and his infamous presidential address. But this book should be better titled Christianity or Self-Assertion, setting Christianity in opposition to the proper self-assertion that attains its true self through service to the people bound by blood. Instead of a Christian faith in God that frees one for service, Kamla preached faithful submission to the fatherland and devotion to one's true neighbors who share a common history. For Kamla, love is not to be directed indiscriminately, but to those whom one is already naturally bound by proximity. As one reviewer notes in 1942, Kamla understands Christianity as the radicalization of a tendency inherent in Judaism, toward a dissolution of nationalism and the isolation of the individual. Kamla sees the political danger of Christianity and the fact that through the renunciation of self-assertion and the doctrine of pilgrimage, Christians withdraw from the nationalist we. They are not only obedient to every foreign king, but at the same time acknowledge Christ as a foreign king. This national socialist new man that Kamla espouses is very much a German soldier fighting in the trenches, defending cultural identity, defined here in specifically ethnic terms. But Kamla's approach, the way he goes about it, is interesting because what he does is he takes Christianity and he demythologizes it. He takes away the all of the kind of superstition in his mind. He takes away the miracles. And what he's left is a broader philosophy that he has directed not toward God, but toward something else. So for him, he sees Christianity collapsing already and wants to provide a new foundation. What is left after the collapse of Christianity? I love this slide, by the way. It has all of the right notes. When faith in God fades from memory, to what must people devote themselves? For Kamla, the answer is political devotion. In a stroke of either brilliance, treachery, or both, Kamla has pillaged the spoils of Christianity in service of the state, proposing politics as an appropriate substitute religion for a nation that can no longer believe in God. Now, some 70 years later, it's clear that what Kamla advocates for and anticipates has, in many ways, come true. As David Zoll notes in his book, Seculosity, with the possible exception of career, politics has become today's most popular replacement religion, certainly the one with the most forward momentum and cultural currency. For many, its substitution for religion has been seamless, hardly even noticeable. And like a religion, politics claims as its own every aspect of everyday life. There isn't any debated topic today that fails to have at least some political significance. Were he alive today, Kamla would probably approve of this shift. Just as Heidegger believed university education was in service of politics, many today see their learning and research to only be worthwhile if it has some tangible implications for public policy. Though the politics in question are, to be sure, light years away from each other, and it would be irresponsible to make a moral equivalence between the two, yet the framework remains remarkably similar. There are liberal churches and conservative churches, liberal schools and conservative schools, liberal and conservative news outlets, websites, comedians, music. The list goes on. We now even expect, to some degree, the purchases we make to carry with them a measure of political righteousness. We expect the brands we love to mirror our values, and they are more than happy to comply in exchange for payment. So, for example, I'm going to start off light here. So this was in 2020, and whatever you make, it's a Black Lives Matter statement. Now, again, I'm not talking politics. What I find most interesting about this isn't the statement, but the one who makes it, and it's hard to see, but it's by Fruit Gushers. Fruit Gushers actually teamed up with Fruit by the Foot to make this. They both shared it on their social media. Great. The second would be, it comes from Paramount. Paramount Global condemns the terrorist attack by Hamas. Okay. Who else? The Walt Disney Company, after the Ukraine war started, issued their own statement. Likewise, companies are happy to advertise the ways in which, true or not, they are in compliance with green initiatives. There is politics is everywhere in everything we buy. And all you need to look at is where, just Google search, if you ever want to fall down this rabbit hole, just Google search, which brand should I boycott? I don't recommend it. So the effect of this shift towards a maximal politics has been far from neutral, actually. As David Brooks noted in a recent article in The Atlantic, if you put people in a moral vacuum, they will seek to fill it with the closest thing at hand. Over the past several years, people have sought to fill the moral vacuum with politics and tribalism. American society has become hyper-politicized. According to research by Ryan Streeter, the director of domestic public policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, lonely people are 7 times more likely to say they are active in politics than young people who aren't lonely. For people who feel disrespected, unseen, and alone, politics is a seductive form of social therapy. Its success has yet to, as a form of social therapy is questionable. Additionally, Kamla, I think with some justification, sees Christian faith as opposed to the kind of political devotion he wants. The two exist on entirely different planets. When Jesus was asked who his neighbor was, he did not point to those of his own ethnic or religious group, but to the foreign Samaritan. Baked into Christianity is not outright opposition to politics, but rather a stark indifference to the questions of the state. But I'm getting ahead of myself. If Kamla calls for total commitment to the cause, to give into the seculosity of politics and enjoy the thrill of the roller coaster, I want to turn next to those who take an entirely different tact, namely punk music. I like punk music. So just so you know, I don't look like a punk, and that's fine. I aged out, but I still listen to it. So punk music is not inherently political so much as the musical distillation of youthful rebellion against all prevailing norms. There are clear exceptions, of course. I'm thinking especially of Green Day's album American Idiot, which waded directly into partisan politics. But to my mind, American Idiot really isn't punk. Now, there's nothing more punk than saying something isn't punk. So I'm really showing my credentials here. American Idiot really isn't punk, but a not-so-veiled money grab capitalizing on anti-war sentiment with focus group-tested lyrics. I really felt good about that. Did you know that a Broadway musical was based on that album? It's hard to get more mainstream than Broadway. So in its genesis, punk was principally a rejection of the political idealism of hippie rock hippie rock and roll in favor of the visceral, unbridled, and abrasive. To take one example, the Sex Pistols song God Save the Queen is certainly an anti-monarchist anthem, but the queen of which they sing is principally the figurehead of an entire system they believe to be a moral failure. God Save the Queen, the fascist regime. It made you a moron, potential H-bomb, God Save the Queen, the fascist regime, etc., etc., etc. In the song's memorable outro, though, the point of the song is made crystal clear. And in fact, the original title of the song was No Future. Beyond it's the anti-monarchist provocation, the song is ultimately a cry of anger and despair. As lead singer and lyricist for the band Johnny Lydon, a.k.a. Johnny Rotten, would later say, "You don't write God Save the Queen because you hate the English race. You write a song like that because you love them, and you're fed up with being mistreated." That's about as lyrical as I could find from him. 10 years later, and 1,000 miles away, the Southern California punk scene had taken off. And its center of the genre's evolution was a band by the name of Bad Religion. Driven by their fast chord changes and elevated lyrical prose, far more so than Sex Pistols, Bad Religion transformed the SoCal punk scene. But despite the distance of time, space, and tempo, the core theme of punks remained the same. In their short minute-and-a-half song, You Are the Government, Bad Religion took aim at nearly everything. Hey, sit down and listen, and they'll tell you when you're wrong. Eradicate but vindicate as progress creeps along. Puritan work ethic maintains its subconscious edge. Puritan work ethic? Like, he's read Max Weber? Okay. As glory maintains your consciousness. If one were to articulate a broader philosophy of punk music and its political bearings, it would be more akin to asceticism than pure nihilism. The world is irredeemably corrupt and going to hell in a handbasket. Salvation from this world, ruled by evil and despair, comes through protest and withdrawal, to find life out of step with what is expected within the counterculture. If politics is a roller coaster, punks prefer not to ride at all, standing on the edge to mock the cruel, twisting buffoonery of it all. With its anti-establishment voice of angst and malcontent, the punk ethos might appear to be an attractive option for staying sane in 2024. The cries of protest from Johnny Rotten and Bad Religion sound remarkably contemporary. Who doesn't, after all, feel in some way both powerless and aggrieved? But within the negative space created by their ridicule and angst, the punk stands outside the world and therefore stands on nothing but spite. For all its energy and anti-establishment invectives, the punk nevertheless depends upon the fallen world it so decries. For all its supposed independence, it still needs the world, looks to the world, lives parasitically upon it as the source of its rebellion. In this way, punk politics are as volatile as they are transitory. Like a firework burst into the sky, rebellion burns hot to a glorious spectacle, but fades quickly. By definition, the punk ethos can never be revolutionary, let alone lasting. For all their youthful vigor, punks don't age well, both literally and metaphorically. After all, every punk will eventually either die young or live long enough to put out an acoustic album. So, where have we been so far? We've seen two alternatives. The first is from Wilhelm Kammler as a seculosity of religion, and the second is from punks and the absolute rejection of it. Next, we turn to the New Testament. Christianity has a funny and fickle relationship to politics. Certainly, readers of the New Testament can employ its themes toward political ends, but they still have to reckon with three, in my view, insurmountable dogmas written into the very DNA of Christianity. The first is that Jesus' ministry had little interest in ethnic or political distinctions. As alluded to before, when Jesus was asked to define one's neighbor, who his neighbor was, and I might say a key question for Jews at the time, as they sought to love their neighbor as themselves, Jesus pointed to a foreigner. Not only that, but Jesus' miracles were given equally to Jew and Roman, rich and poor, men and women. The type of love Jesus espoused was precisely the kind that philosopher Kammler abhorred. The very distinctions of peoples necessary to enact orderly governance, the construction of geographic, cultural, or ethnic social boundaries, are precisely the ones Jesus had no time for. When it came to those in need, Jesus did not check passports. Now, to be sure, what we view as the quite natural distinction between private religion and political governance, right? We have politics, we have religion, and we think of those as two. That distinction has very little relation to how ancient Judaism and the Roman world thought about how politics and religion interacted. These were not two separate entities, but thoroughly intertwined. It has very little to do with, so that distinction has very little to do with ancient world thought. The enmeshment between the two in Jesus' day only underscores how paltry the evidence is for a Jesus with specific political ambition or import. Now, many people do write a political revolutionary Jesus. Now, what they won't tell you, or what they will tell you, it's sort of hidden, is the way they get to that has everything to do with how certain historical Jesus reconstructions happen. Can I geek out on historical Jesus research for a second? So principally, someone like Reza Aslan, who wrote a book called Zealot. It was very popular a few years ago. Now, what Reza Aslan does is he takes as a presupposition that the gospel narratives are inherently wrong about how they present Jesus' teachings. So what he does is he takes the teachings of Jesus out of the narratives and he views them as a standalone item. And the context in which he replaces them is his own. It has to do with this bitter conflict between Jews and Romans. So he takes, for example, the parable of the tenants, which Jesus in the Gospels likens himself to the son, right? But if you take that out of the narrative, what you're left with is a peasant's revolt. So you have a Jesus who's espousing a peasant's revolt only by way of a reconstructed historical context that the historian imports into teachings that are separated from the narratives. That's how this. So anyway, that's my hobby horse. It might or might not be what I wrote my PhD on. Now, to illustrate this point, I want to draw your attention to one of my favorite scenes in the New Testament, namely Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday, particularly as recorded in the Gospel of Mark. Oh, I missed one. Jesus enters into Jerusalem by way of its southernmost gate to shouts of praise. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. See, Jesus is acclaimed as a king by those who are crying out for salvation. He's riding a horse through the very gates that the Roman armies would have. So there's a kind of parallel that's being presented, certainly historically, but also on a narrative level, between Jesus as this king triumphantly marching into the ancient capital city and those Roman generals who would likewise march. There's a rivalry juxtaposition being made between those two. But then what happens next, though? It's the greatest little detail. As soon as this all happens, the great fanfare, Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple courts. The parade has come to its destination. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. I like to call this the great disappointment in Jesus' ministry, where crowds and thongs, they gather around and they're very excited, and Jesus is like, I'm tired. I'm going to go to bed. Now, what's going on there is a kind of, it's wading into the thorny things of Jesus is king, but he's not, the end of his procession is a few days away, right? His kingly procession, this is what Mark is doing actually, does not end in the temple with Jesus cleansing the temple and having some big demonstration. The end of Jesus' kingly procession is the cross. That's where Mark is actually going. So the first one, Jesus had very little interest in political distinctions. The second, Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate, as the Apostles' Creed says. Now, it is difficult to underestimate how significant it was that Jesus died at the hands of a political authority who acted in a perfectly reasonable and even just fashion. According to Roman law, there was nothing illegal or underhanded about how Pilate handled the trial and the execution of Jesus. Pilate was not, for example, immediately recalled to Rome to face an inquiry. If anything, he played his cards perfectly. With its founder having been lawfully executed by the state, to say nothing of the official and unofficial persecution of Christians in the centuries that followed, Christianity has had a difficult time extrapolating its beliefs in a meaningful political engagement. Point three, the mission of the church extends to all. Now, this is sort of the kind of thing that everyone says and understands, but when you sort of ask that question in the realm of the political, things go haywire. Right? Jesus' final instruction to the disciples were to do exactly as he had done throughout his ministry, traveling in successive concentric circles outward from Jerusalem to Judea to the ends of the earth, quoting Acts, the disciples were to carry Jesus' message in all directions to the four corners of the globe, not, as it were, bearing swords of conquest, but armed with his words alone, teaching them all that I have commanded you, and baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, there are other difficulties one can name, such as the absence in Jesus' teaching of more theocratic ideals we find in Judaism or Islam. But the indifference of Jesus toward politics, while mirrored in many forms of Christianity in the 2,000 years since, does not, I think, provide a complete picture for how we might stay sane, right? That's a different question. It's certainly better to be than either a post-Christian political replacement religion or the angst of punk's anti-establishmentarianism. Come on, that's the longest word I've gotten into a paper. But it doesn't straightforwardly address how we might respond today to the incessant political claims made upon us. Now for that, we turn to the Apostle Paul. I love this picture. It's super small, I understand. But if you see in the very, very far right-hand side, there's this kind of sword. Paul often has a sword as the defender of the faith, but he's not wielding it. He wields a pen as his chosen instrument. We turn to Paul. Paul advances the gospel across the world stage, from Galatia to Corinth, to Thessalonica, and ultimately Rome itself. But the drama of world history he narrates does not see Rome or any other power as its chief rival. There is a linguistic overlap between many of Paul's key terms in Roman propaganda. So, for example, the usage of the term euangelion, or good news, was one that was used by Caesar. Or the designation of the gathering of the believers as ecclesia, or assembly, has parallels to other Roman assemblies. Or the acclamation of Jesus as Lord, worthy of worship, might parallel Caesar is Lord. I'm wading into a little bit of a debate, and I'm not going to name names. But Paul's writing could have these resonances, right, to some of his readers. But it's not actually what Paul was doing. Paul, in his mind, was using fairly commonplace language that people used. He wasn't naming names, like I am not naming names. No, instead, the rivals of Christianity Paul explicitly names do not wear togas. Instead, the Spirit moves against broader cosmic forces of sin, flesh, and death that operate in human lives on the earthly stage. To Paul, there is nothing in this world that is not touched by these destructive powers. As it was for Jesus, Paul divided the world between those who are being saved and those on their way to destruction. There is the Spirit that gives life, and then there is everything else that leads to death. In this way, Paul does espouse a doctrine of two kingdoms, but the fault line lies not between the spiritual and the political, or between the church and the state, but between the power of the Spirit who rescues us from the clutches of death and the world that is still firmly within death's grasp. In doing so, Paul ascribes what we might term the political to the world ruled by sin and death. Consequently, Paul espouses something, we might say, of a punk ethos. Paul the punk. If I was really good at Photoshop, I would change that photo to have him with a mohawk. Anyway, Paul is anti-establishment in the sense that he believes the rulers of this age are being brought to nothing. Paul sees the same hopelessness and corruption that punks see in this world. But he names them sin and death. But Paul's incisive diagnosis should not be misconstrued with the punk ethos of rebellion. Anger is a heck of a drug, but not one Paul employs. See, for Paul, he does not stand on spite, but rather something else entirely. Those who are in Christ live according to a very different pattern of beliefs than that of the world, not on the basis of spite or anger, instead something else. Instead, those who are in Christ are to espouse values that mirror the pattern of the self-giving Lord to whom they belong. Values that do, in fact, stand in sharp contrast to that of the world. Paul's churches welcomed everyone, regardless of social status. They were to eschew factions and rivalries, outdo one another in showing honor, and showing honor to others, while striving for peace and humility. On the basis of the gift or grace of Christ, Christians were to give generously, regardless of the worth of the recipient. Paul and his churches were deeply countercultural, subversive even. But their radicality with regard to Roman values was incidental rather than determinative. Christians were not defined, are not, for Paul, defined by what they are against, but by whom they are rescued. Given the natural contrast between Christian values and the practices and Roman cultural ideals, the complete absence of references to Caesar, Roman power, the imperial cult, or Roman law is telling. Paul does mention Caesar once. When he sends greetings to those faithful believers who are of Caesar's household. There is no other reference to Caesar. It's telling that he does so. Jesus was, after all, crucified by a Roman official. Paul, too, was repeatedly imprisoned by Roman authorities. So it's not that Paul was ignorant of Roman rule, but that he saw it as unworthy of his attention. As John Barclay has written, Paul's most subversive act vis-a-vis the Roman Empire was not to oppose or upstage it, but to relegate it to the rank of a dependent derivative entity, denied a distinguishable name or significant role in the story of the world. Now, for modern readers of Paul, this possibility is, of course, unthinkable. We who are so enmeshed within political strife would prefer an apostle who mirrors the political urgency we feel. But for Paul, on the scale of human history, politics is not ultimately anything, or penultimately anything. Politics, in this way for Paul, is most certainly not a religion. It can never replace the lordship of Christ, nor should it. Instead, Paul has bigger fish to fry than to meddle with the Caesars, whose names change every 15 years. To do so would, in Paul's mind, ascribe to them far more significance than they deserve, while simultaneously debasing the significance of Christian proclamation as just another talking head on cable news. Again, Paul was not blissfully unaware of political realities, but what Paul proclaims is far too precious, far too invaluable, to define its relevance within the terms handed to him by Rome. The same may be said of Alexandria, Athens, or any other political power moving forward in history. So in other words, the relevancy of Christianity has nothing to do with how its values might or might not be translated into public policy for Paul. Instead, the relevancy of Christianity has everything to do with the ways sin and death twist the goodness of creation into its opposite, and the battle won by the Spirit in Christ through his resurrection to overcome and ultimately defeat all of the powers of evil. That is the story Paul tells. So how do you stay sane in an election year? It might be tempting to hop on the roller coaster and have fun, to dive into every Facebook post and potentially lose all your friends in the process, but hey, you do you. It might be tempting to do that, to have a kind of, have everything, your entire emotional being and satisfaction hinge upon this one event. Or it might be tempting to say, screw it all, that everything is corrupt, so why even bother? But Paul charts something different. Paul would, in some ways, agree with the kind of punk rejection, but he does so because he cares about something far more. In other words, what moves his heart is not the ticker at the bottom of a screen, but the Lord to him who changed his life. The thing that most matters to Paul is the goodness, the grace, the forgiveness, the life-giving Spirit given to him by God. And that has captured his affections. That is the love of God poured into his heart. And in light of that, Caesar's may change. He has no interest. He does not wish to wrestle with a pig because the pig gets dirty. You get dirty and the pig likes it. Paul instead sees the world in cosmic scale, the one who is at the top, the one who all of history is moving toward, is none other than Jesus Christ, who was died and raised from the dead for all to live. So it's a small thing. Thank you so much for coming today. I don't know if we have time for questions or not, but I'm...
Can I ask one?
Sure.
Does it matter that we're in a democracy, or is that just an excuse to kind of be more anxious about it?
You know, Paul was... the Romans weren't entirely undemocratic. They had a Senate. And it just looks different than the one we have. So that's the best. So that's the best way I can sort of describe it. In other words, the way that political power is structured may not matter to Paul, because the unwritten part and the unexplored thought that I have would be a likening of political power to some measure of coercion and control, and I wonder whether, to what degree Paul would, how that maps on to Paul's thought or not. But that's unexplored, so please don't quote me on that one. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is he not doing what you say? Is he not eschewing politics? Is he not separating what ultimately becomes Christianity from Roman law?
So he's actually wading into a very... So one, the first thing to note about that scene is that he addresses it only because he's asked. So he doesn't raise Caesar's name because he wishes to do so, but rather he's responding to a question. The second is that he's wading into a very Jewish question, because Jews were given, in some sense, special permissions within Roman law, and they existed uncomfortably within Roman law. So, And so the render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and render unto Paul, unto God that which is God's is a phrase that has had a lot of salience over the years. But I tend to think that he's just responding to paying taxes. I think it's... I think the significance can be greater, but at least within the narrative, he's being asked the question about taxes, whether you should pay taxes. And he's like, yeah. I say that in part because we see other non-canonical gospels in the future wade into that ambiguity. They don't like it. They want to extend it. Is it good to give to Caesar that which is owed to him? All the property that is owed to him. So you see already within early Christianity a kind of trajectory away from what seems to be a fairly limited scope of a question to a broader. And to me, that movement exhibits a dissatisfaction with what it means, as much as it might reflect the potential excessive meaning of the saying. So, yeah.
I appreciate the foundation you kind of laid for us and find it really helpful. But I also note that you didn't lay out much practical going forward.
Yeah.
Because that's the hardest question to ask. But what I heard you say, I guess I'm asking for some clarity,
yeah,
is not to just dive in for the sport of it, also not to opt out for the craziness of it, but somehow, as a pastor of a small congregation, like, mm-hmm, to wade in to it in a thoughtful way. Can you say anything more about what that might look like?
Yeah, I think Paul is ideologically revolutionary, right? He, as I sort of tried to outline, when Paul says outdo one another in showing honor, he's not doing that, saying that into a vacuum. He's speaking it into a Roman culture in which the garnering of one's honor, and honor was a competitive enterprise. The more honor you had, it was like how we think of identity. It was the thing you fought for most. And so when Paul says outdo one another in showing honor to other people, he's very much not ignorantly wading into how that happens. Even the quid pro quo, like, there's lots of things, the salience of cultural salience to that phrase. But he doesn't do so, for example, by naming a senator who donates money to the local magistrate in order to have his name, his placard, placed on the side of a road built in his honor. He doesn't do that. He has an ideological critique without having much interest in sort of sullying, getting into those questions. So, yeah. Yes, there's two hands. Everett, for.
Talk something about Romans 13.
Yeah.
And in terms of Paul's vision of those who have power and control over us.
Romans 13 is often taken as a kind of damning with faint praise to Caesar. Paul really was revolutionary, and he just wrote this in order to appease Roman officials who might intercept the letter. That's often what's said. So what they'll say is, these are the kind of pro political Paul people will say everything Paul says is politically subversive in direct, tangible ways, and you get to Romans 13, and he adds this little bow just in case anyone was about to start a riot. And I tend to think that that's not what Paul's doing. I think in general, Paul doesn't. The idea of Roman authority was, in some senses, absolute. He couldn't imagine a world in which. He couldn't imagine a world in which they were overthrown with immediate impact outside of the eschaton. Paul thought that Jesus was coming back tomorrow, right? And that frames how he talks about how Christians should live in the here and now, to live in the world, but as if the world did not have impinge upon them, to have it... to not escape from the world, but nevertheless to not have the world be that which determines your identity and your fate and your and what you believe to be true. So I tend to think, yeah. So that's the broader kind of how I think of Romans 13. Okay, we have the last question.
So, like, despite not being directly politically subversive, like the cult of Caesar and cult of Augustus and just the divinity of the Roman imperial system was such like a central part of the Roman government.
Yeah.
And like to Augustus establishing himself as the figurehead, that like it was still a direct threat to Rome, essentially, to promulgate this idea that there's no king.
It would become.
Yeah.
Within Paul's lifetime, Romans didn't bother about, didn't think it was all that significant. And there's an early letter from one kind of Roman official to another to say, what do we do about these Christians? They're not paying homage to Caesar. Which, to me, says that there was no policy or anything like that. Yeah, for sure. Paul wasn't participating in the imperial cult. Right?
And we see Sallust writing, like, there are these Christians, like, I don't know, they're doing something weird.
Yeah.
We don't really pay that much attention to them. Like, you think in today's world where we see that religion and politics are so separate, that there's still kind of, like, even if we focus on religion, there's, like, a cult of politics, basically, feels a subversion, feels threatened by that, even if that's not the intent, in a similar way.
Sure. I mean, there's I would... If you don't pay attention, if you don't ascribe ultimacy to the political, people will say you're a traitor. You know, in a world of fugitives, the one running the opposite direction will appear to be a traitor. So, to quote T.S. Eliot, I'm not that smart.